Cortland, I thank you for such a gracious introduction. May I say that I'm very pleased to share the platform with Reid Irvine. I think that Accuracy in Media is an organization which is performing a very great service to the country. In considering what I might speak with you about today, which might be useful, I thought it, rather than cover just one or two topics, I would try to range for a moment on the communications revolution. Just some general aspects of it for your consideration. And then, if these meet with your interest, we can develop them in the question and answer later. Because I think that the communications revolution, which Cortland referred to, and saying that most thinking people now in the West are highly focused on the media and society, I think the communications revolution is now in a state where it's having fundamental impact on mankind. When I speak of the communications revolution, I am first of all speaking of a lot of technical devices, things like radio and motion pictures and high-speed press and records and stereophonic sound and transistors and transistor radio and television and audio tape and satellites and even such things as jet engines, because that has enabled us to move more rapidly from place to place and have person-to-person contact, which is the most valuable form of all communication. The result, however, of all these devices is much more important than the devices themselves. The result is that mankind now knows more rapidly, with much greater effect than ever before in history. And that all of this has happened in 50 years. 60 years, really two generations. We in this room constitute the first television generation, or perhaps our children, I should say, do. The growth in the devices which caused the communications revolution and the growth in the impact of the devices is exponential, I submit. Let me give you some examples. In terms of impact, about 3 years ago, while with the USIA that Cortland referred to, I was in Western Africa, and I was driving along in a Land Rover, and I passed a Maasai warrior wrapped in a blanket and holding a spear, standing by the side of the road. There was no one else around that I could see for miles. And as one drove by him, you thought, gee, that fellow could have been there 1,000 years ago. He has just a blanket, and he has the spear, and he's all alone on this African plain. My son, who's 18, was with me, and we stopped to take a picture, and so we got fairly close to him. And it was then I realized that he had a transistor radio stuck in his ear. The exponential growth of devices. Westinghouse Laboratories announced about 3 weeks ago, let me say in telling you this and being with Westinghouse, I don't understand the laboratory, so I'm just telling you something that they announced. Westinghouse Laboratories announced the first step toward a pocket radio style of television, the development of a thin, transistorized screen no thicker than a window pane. Now, can you imagine that Maasai warrior with a transistor television in his pocket, linked by satellite to the whole rest of the world? And what changes that man has been subjected to by transistorized radio, and what he will be subjected to when transistorized pocket-style television linked to satellites comes upon him. This communications revolution, then, devices and impact, what is its effect on society? Three things for you to generally think about, out of very many. I submit that the communications revolution is causing a rise in discontent, a rise in nationalism, and a rise in the difficulty of the ability to govern. Rise in discontent. More people now are volatile, mercurial, quick to react, restless than at most other times in history. The young are restless. The explosion of the 60s. I mentioned to you television's first generation. Television started in 1950. By 1965, a 15-year-old had never known a time in that child's life without television. Is it coincidence or is it cause and effect that youth became more restless when the first television generation came into being? The blacks in the United States in the last 25 years or 20 years have become increasingly restless, as have the young. Is it coincidence or cause and effect that high volatility, mercurial feeling, restlessness among the blacks in the United States occurred at the same time as the first maturing television generation of blacks? I would point out here parenthetically that if there is a cause and effect relationship, I suggest you consider not the most obvious things like the effect of television news or even the effect of television advertising, but something much deeper and maybe more profound than that. In a situation comedy, the normal American family is shown having a nice house and a nice kitchen and a nice car and a white picket fence and nice clothes. And that went into all of those ghetto homes and all of those homes of blacks throughout the United States. And that was presented as a normal background. Every American had that. That wasn't something unique. That wasn't something for the rich. That wasn't something for those in the better part of town. That was merely the normal backdrop of a situation comedy set in the United States. What effect would that have on you if perhaps you were never going to have that? So in discontent, youth has been more restless, blacks have been more restless, and a third instance for you to consider is Vietnam, the first war ever fought on television, and the intense, the enormously intense emotions of the American people. Because the war in Vietnam was not really fought in an emotional sense in Vietnam. It was fought right in the living room of an American family in Iowa who night after night after night after night saw all the slaughter of American young there in their living room. Now that's very difficult to take, even though you may feel that it is morally justified. The intense emotionalism becomes very highly focused. Was the intense emotionalism of Vietnam greater than any other war in our history? And the fact that it was the first war that was fought on television, was that coincidence or is there a cause and effect relationship? So I submit that the rise of discontent may be in some way related to the communications revolution. There is a second phenomenon which occurs over a longer span, a span of 50 to 60 years, but isn't that just the span of the communications revolution? And that's the rise of nationalism. Nationalism, described in modern language, would be doing your own thing. We want to run our lives our way with our people under our rules. We don't want any other nation of people telling us what to do. Nationalism. Nationalism has had a 50-year explosion. It began roughly at World War I, after 300 or 400 years of the formation of empires, which really is one group of people, one nationality, ruling another group of people, either adjacent to you or far away. At the end of World War I, since the sea-based empires, England and France and Holland and Belgium, won the war, the land-based empires were broken up. The German Empire, the Austro-Hungarian Empire, and the Turkish Empire. And all of those states of the Turkish Empire became Arab states. And all of the Austro-Hungarian states became Eastern Europe, Czechoslovakia and Hungary and Austria and the rest. And Germany was, of course, broken up. In World War II, a phenomena occurred. The sea-based empires won the war again. But this time, the sea-based empires broke up. France lost her empire. French Indochina became Laos, became Cambodia, became Vietnam. All of French Africa became a group of states. The Belgian Empire broke up. The Belgian Congo became Zaire. The Dutch Empire broke up. Dutch East Indies became Indonesia. And the English Empire, on which the sun never set, the sun set. And so you had, in World War I and World War II, for reasons that I submit included the communications revolution, but which were by no means restricted to it, you had the rise of nationalism, the breakup of empires. But since World War II, as communications has tended to explode, look what has happened to nationalism everywhere, all over the world. Even with the powerful empires broken up, the virus of nationalism has moved forward. First, you had in the subcontinent of Asia, India. And then you had a frightful struggle, and you had India and Pakistan. And then you had another frightful struggle, and you had India and Pakistan and Bangladesh. And in Africa, from 1960 to 1970, 39 new nations were formed. If you describe a nation by an organism that gets into the United Nations, 39 new nations in 10 years. And you take a place today which is in headlines all the time, the Persian Gulf. You had a little group of states called the Trucial States under England, and now what are they? They are the state of Bahrain, the state of Qatar, the state of the United Arab Emirates, the state of Oman. Everywhere, the smallest countries, the smallest nations, I should say, people who have a common language and heritage and religion, culture, say, we want to do our own thing. No one else is going to rule us. Today, right where we're sitting here, you have Cyprus tearing itself apart because 125,000 Turks and 500,000 Greeks can't get along on one of the most paradisical islands that exists in this world. The Kurds in northern Iraq want to break away, mostly from Iraq, but also from part of Iran, from part of Turkey, and become Kurdistan. We talked about the struggle between India and Pakistan, but there's something between India and Pakistan, and that's a place called Baluchistan or Baluchistan. And now there's a struggle there, and they want to form their own separate country, and probably will. And you have an old man, 82 I believe he is, running a country on the Adriatic, Tito, and he's going to die soon, and he's really the only Yugoslav. You ask him what he is, he says he's a Yugoslav. If you ask anyone else in Yugoslavia what they are, they say, I'm a Serb, or I'm a Croat, or I'm a Slovene, or I'm a Macedonian, or one of the other two nationalities that make up Yugoslavia. Can Yugoslavia survive after the cement of that man passes on? I submit, probably not. And lest you think that nationalism and its rise is confined to lesser breeds, Canada, French Canada, and Canada, English Canada, are increasingly intense in their emotions one with the other. In the United Kingdom in the last election, the Scottish Nationalist Party said that if it won enough votes, it would start a move for independence, and it won in Scotland an astonishing 30% of the vote. It became the second party, replacing the Conservatives. Prime Minister Wilson has now promised elected assemblies with limited power in Scotland to forestall what? A move for independence from England by Scotland. And in Ireland, I think the situation is more religious between Northern and Southern Ireland than it is ethnic, but I only mention Ireland because I want to tell you an Irish story. And I had to drag it in some way. This Irish story goes along the lines of what is the solution to the perennial Irish question. If there are any Irishmen in the room, I'm Irish too, so don't come up after me when I tell this story. What is the solution to the perennial Irish problem? The solution is to take all of the people from Ireland and to move them to Holland, and to take all of the people from Holland and to move them to Ireland. And in a short period of time, the Dutch will make Ireland the garden spot of this earth. And in an equally short period of time, the Irish will neglect the dikes and thus resolve the Irish problem. The force of nationalism. I really became aware of the force of nationalism only when I traveled a very great deal for the government and was assigned as in the USIA, the task of relating to foreign peoples. And you become aware of the tremendous, impassioned, deep-seated emotion of nationalism in foreign peoples. Now, we in the United States don't understand it. Why don't we understand it? because our experience was unique. We broke away, our forefathers did, from different nations for the purpose of leaving those nations and coming to an empty continent and forming a new nation. And we really are a melting pot. We no longer think of ourselves as Italians or Irish or Germans or Poles. We think of ourselves as Americans. But people in foreign countries who are in their traditional ancestral land with their own religion and their own language and their own heritage and their own culture, and they're taken over by another country, a sister country, they never accept it. There's no possibility of a melting pot. And so the virulence of nationalism is something which is very important, I think, in judging world emotions and in judging what a communications revolution works on in terms of a substratum of human feeling, and something that we Americans are peculiarly inept for understandable reasons in judging. In the United Nations, that organization has gone from 40 to 140 states in 25 years. In the current session, there were three new members: Guinea-Bissau from Africa, Bangladesh from Asia, and Grenada from the Caribbean. They have four things in common. They're poor, they're socialist, they need U.S. technology, food, and money, and they will vote against us in the United Nations. A little tiny group of islands called the Seychelles. Most of you probably know that's in the middle of the Indian Ocean. It's only important because the Russian Navy is now starting to operate in the Indian Ocean, and that will mean that a Western Navy will have to start operating, and when the Suez Canal opens and with the pressure on the Persian Gulf, that's going to be a very strategic situation. The Seychelles will get its independence from England in the latter part of 1975. It will then join the United Nations. It has 56,000 people, which is 4,000 less than Greenwich, Connecticut, where I live. Now, in discussing the tremendous rise of nationalism and what it means, and saying, is it cause or effect that it has occurred in the last 60 years, coincidentally with the communications revolution? People wanting to do their own thing, like the blacks in the U.S. and like the young and all of that. There's one place, there's one great empire that still exists in the world today, the last imperialist state, and that's the Union of Soviet Socialist Republics. Because, of course, the Russian nation is a minority in the Soviet Union, as most of you well know. The Russians rule other nations that they took over in the period of the Tsars, essentially. They rule the Georgians, the Ukrainians, the Latvians, the Estonians, the Lithuanians, the Tatars, the Uzbeks, and many other. And lest you think that this is like Alabama or Maine or Texas, these people, as those of you who traveled in the Soviet Union well know, have a different language, a different culture, a different religion, an ancestral territory, an ancestral culture. They dislike the Russians, and they feel exactly about the Russians as the Irish feel about the English. They don't want to be ruled by them. Or as the Pakistanis felt about the Indians. Or as the Turks and the Greeks feel. They don't want to be ruled by a foreign nation. The Soviet leaders are obviously enormously worried whether the world explosion of nationalism, which has now destroyed every empire in the world, save one, the Soviet Union, which has swept through the free world, maybe because the communications revolution is allowed to operate in the free world. What will it do in the Soviet Union? They've interdicted the communications revolution. And the Marxist-Leninist theory holds that nationalism is merely a passing phenomena of capitalism. But I think that's nonsense. They have a policy of Russification, which means that in little countries like Latvia and Estonia, they are trying to move in cadres of Russians, Russian families, in order to Russianize the areas. They do everything they can to interdict the communications revolution. Query: if nationalism has exploded against all forces and in all economic conditions, everywhere in the free world, can it be long interdicted in the Union of Soviet Socialist Republics so that the Russian nation can rule other nations in the happenstance of an imperialist state? Solzhenitsyn and Amalric have both spoken out in this and say no, that it may be the Achilles heel of the Soviet Union. In closing, I suggested that there were possibly three things among many that were worth special consideration on the communications revolution: the rise of discontent, the rise of nationalism. Those two merged together and coupled with a lot of other phenomena are now producing, as the communications revolution becomes exponential, an apparent extraordinary difficulty in governing today. It is now November. We're in the 11th month of 1974. In this year, 1974, a phenomenon has occurred which has never before occurred in that period of time in the history of the West, namely, that almost every major Western government has either been overthrown, fallen, had a coup, or had to go back to the people to test its form of government, that is, to be reelected. So there has been a government change, or a government test, or a government coup of some sort in this year, in England, in France, in Italy, in Germany, in Luxembourg, in Portugal, in Greece, in Cyprus, in Iceland, in the United States, in Canada, in Australia, in Japan, in Ethiopia, and in Thailand, to name the ones which simply came readily to mind as I put these notes down. Political parties are weakening throughout the world. Most countries, the party in power is only very slightly in power. The destruction in the last 10 years of the top United States leaders, Kennedy by assassination, and then Johnson and Agnew and Nixon by an extraordinary impact on the public mind, and presently Rockefeller and Ford being subjected to intense pressures. And so you have six United States leaders in 10 years, four of whom were really destroyed, and two of whom, the only two we now have, are under now extraordinary pressure. Are these men weaker or more sinful or different than all the other leaders we have had, or is the climate different? Is it simply becoming much more difficult to govern? And so as governments fall all through the West, and as leaders of the strongest nation in the West fall, is that part of the exponential impact of the communications revolution? Is there in some way a relationship? The communists recognize the communications revolution. When President Nixon went to China, there was a meeting of a very senior officer of the United States government with Chu Enlai at the time that Nixon was with Mao. And as he was waiting in Chu Enlai's anteroom to see him, a young lady came in, and she was seated there, and she had something with her. And through his interpreter, he chatted with her and said, "What is that that you have there?" And she very unabashedly said, "That is the layout of tomorrow morning's front page for the approval by the premier." In the Soviet Union, when Ivan Denisovich was first published — that's the only work of Solzhenitsyn's that's ever been published in the Soviet Union — they held a meeting of the Central Committee and then of the Politburo in order to take votes. Each man was sent the manuscript marked top secret, and they met, and then each man had to vote on whether or not they would publish that book. That would be the equivalent of the United States Cabinet meeting with the President to vote on whether they would publish a book in the United States. I was in Portugal the last 2 weeks of August, and I spent a great deal of time with some media people and some embassy people and others that I knew. And they all said that the move in on the media, on radio, television, and newspapers in Portugal by the far left in Portugal is the one thing they fear most, because they now have almost totally entrenched control of the media in Portugal. So the communists recognize the communications revolution. Do we recognize the communications revolution? We in the West and we in the United States. At that same visit of the presidents that caused the little story that I gave you about Chu Enlai improving the layout of the newspaper, when President Nixon gave his toast at the end of the major dinner, the big dinner, the state dinner that was given by Chu Enlai, he quoted two quotes which were deeply disturbing, at least to someone who maybe overthinks in communications terms. The Valley Forge of the communist rule in China is something called the Long March, as you well know. We took the Long March together. And the Long March to them means what Valley Forge did to us. And their constitution, their Bill of Rights, since they don't have anything like that, are quotations from Chairman Mao. That's sort of the fountainhead of wisdom. And so if there are two essential communication symbols of the communist rule, the tyrannical communist rule in mainland China, it is the Long March and quotations from Chairman Mao. And when the president of the free world, which is what the president of the United States is, gave his final toast in Peking, he suggested that the United States and China were about to embark on a long march together. And then he quoted extensively the quotations of Chairman Mao. In the Soviet Union, when they visited, the same president, I mention this because this is a president who is a conservative president, not a president of the left, but a president of the right. In the final communique of the first visit of a president of the United States to the Soviet Union, the communique said that the United States and the Soviet Union were now about to embark on a period of peaceful coexistence, which all of you know is the exact terminology that the communists use to describe something which is not in our terms peaceful coexistence, but the carrying on of warfare by other means. So that when one looks at the sensitivity or the lack of sensitivity about the stunning impact of the communications revolution on society and on Western society, you wonder whether or not there is a full recognition of our own leaders on what the communications revolution may be doing. The communications revolution, at minimum, has paralleled social ferment in our time. It raises questions. Does Western media reflect the root values of Western society? Three brief quotes. Most television newsmen tend to be liberal and possibly left of center as well. They come to feel little allegiance to the established order. I think they're inclined to side with humanity rather than with authority and institutions. That's Walter Cronkite in 1973. The more highly educated media men today, especially those in Washington, have become members of an adversary culture that is frequently hostile to traditional values and institutions. That's Daniel Moynihan in 1971. The national media is a melting pot where the journalists, regardless of background, are welded into a homogeneous ideological mold, joined to the liberal establishment and alienated from the masses of the country. That's Robert Novak of Evans Novak. Now, the reason I chose those three quotes are because Walter Cronkite, Daniel Moynihan, and Robert Novak are not considered conservatives. The question arises, does Western media reflect root values of the West? Is there any confidence among the people in the media as to what those root values are or should be? Does the anti-establishment orientation, if there is an anti-establishment orientation of Western media, coupled with the monolithic self-praise of all communist media, tend to mislead people in third world countries? I would submit to you, there's no way of proving this, it's just an opinion, that if an election could be held in the third world today between free enterprise and socialism, third world being Africa and Asia and much of Latin America and the Pacific nations, I think that socialism would win going away from free enterprise, which has provided more for man's spiritual freedom and material well-being than any other method that has ever been tried in man's history. What is the solution? Certainly, press freedom must be preserved. It's absolutely essential to the democracy. One of the solutions is that the citizens must be more active in critiquing the media and in making themselves felt. One of the great tragedies of what happened to Spiro Agnew is that he may very well have been exactly right in much of his critique of the media, but when he ended up taking money in little small envelopes and destroyed his character before the American people, it tended to destroy what may have been a very, very valid thing that he was doing in, from a position of great leadership, pointing out that the citizens have a responsibility to speak out on what they consider are the root values or the lack of root values of the mass media in the United States and in the West. The communications revolution is profoundly affecting and possibly fundamentally altering the social and political values of the West. It is a circumstance that requires the attention of its most thoughtful citizens, and therefore I commend it to your attention. Thank you.